I'm Chris.
I'm Neil.
And I'm Stargate Pioneer, and we're the hosts of the Starling Tribune podcast.
A podcast member of the Gonna Geek Network.
Just like the show you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of each individual.
Check out all the other podcasts
at GonnaGeekNetwork.com.
And get ready.
Because geekiness begins in
3, 2, 1.
Hello, I'm Colin Baker, known to my friends as Old Sixty, the sixth Doctor in that wonderful series Doctor Who. And I am proud to tell you, you are listening to me, and also Gallifrey Public Radio, the radio that brings you everything from Doctor Who to Rhino Wants a Wife, which is a book written by Lucy Baker, my daughter. It's a children's book. You can get it from fbspublishing.co.uk, and it's about a rhinoceros who is lonely and wants a wife, and it's illustrated by my other daughter's boyfriend, and it's a bargain. Buy it.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten.
Did you just say womp womp?
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I like it with the helmet on.
And Keir Hansen.
And that's why, to this day, I can't eat cotton candy.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 216 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we go spelunking deep in the Earth's crust for the good of scientific advancement, and we're going to keep quiet about anything weird that happens. You got it? Not a word. If there's one thing we've learned from poking around in uncharted territory, it's that we don't talk about strange occurrences. I am your host, Haley, and with me in the GPR studios this week, I have Mr. Keir Hansen. How are you today, Keir?
I am keeping shtum. That's what I'm doing.
And also
nothing
we
wrong
have...
here.
That's right. Mr. Jay Witten, how are you today, Jay?
I'm just going to sit here in the corner and act like a complete jerk the entire time so everyone's happy when I die.
Just like always. Got it.
Radiation poisoning. What a way to go.
So this week, we descend one step further into the Pertwee era in our classic rewatch with Doctor Who and the Silurians, or just the Silurians if you overlook the error in the title graphics. Hey, there you go. There's a free one for the pub trivia. It's a 7-part story with a little bit of everything. A new villain species, unit, untrustworthy guys in suits, Liz Shaw taking absolutely zero crap from men who don't recognize her intellect, a really painful TV score, and Bessie, like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang with alien tech instead of Disney magic.
Yeah, next time the Jeep breaks down, I'm just going to pour this weird red glop into the radiator and just stand behind it. Everything's great now.
Yep.
Okay. Well, this is I would say by a lot of estimations, kind of a love it or hate it kind of story. It is a longer one. I was really surprised that on the heels of Spearhead from Space, they decided to go immediately into a 7-parter, back to videotaping, instead of the film that they used for Pertwee's premiere, and. As Jay mentioned, there's a lot going on in here as far as what they pack into this story. If you look at it on the surface, if you really take it apart, it may not hold up quite as well. Just as far as if you really get into the weeds of the semantics of this. But I'll turn it over to our designated guinea pig, Haley.
Yes.
What did we think about this second outing from Pertwee?
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. I'm in.
Okay. Well, okay. So I'm gonna ask you to quantify that momentarily. Okay. But Jay, your overall take on this one?
You know, it's interesting enough, but once you've seen it and you understand who the antagonists are, it loses a lot because that's a lot of the story, is trying to figure out, okay, is it Dr. Quinn? Is it the director guy? Is it the Silurians? You're trying to figure out where all these people fit into the main story. So that once you know the overall plot, you're just kind of like, okay, can we get to the part where they do the thing now? Can we just, this is really unnecessary.
Okay. And that's where I'm going to put it right back to you, Haley. As far as this is 160 some odd minutes of total invested.
It would be a long movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would say it could easily be trimmed down into four parts and probably be a tighter story for it, but I enjoyed it.
Okay.
Still.
All right. And I probably agree with that. I mean, I go through, I'm probably at least through the first four, possibly even five episodes, and really enjoying it. You know, I'm kind of getting along with a little bit of the campiness of it. You know, I haven't quite gotten completely grated by the sound of the Silurian third eye wavy beams. But I will say that whatever that electric kazoo is that they're using in the score, that sounds a little bit like the Silurian eye beam, but isn't. And it sounds comedic to me personally. I know it's supposed to sound, you know, extraterrestrial in nature, but when I'm hearing whap, whap, every 4 minutes for close to 3 hours, I'm done.
I don't know how familiar everyone is with Legend of Zelda, but I thought the Silurians looked a lot like Zoras, and then they started playing that music, and I was like, I think that's one of the things you had to play on the flute in Legend of Zelda.
yeah. Well, and this obviously being the first of three, well, technically four, I guess, depends on how you count it, variations of the Silurian race that we get exposed to through Who. But this is a very similar kind of conflict that we're dealing with that we end up getting in The Hungry Earth, you know, decades and decades later. Mm-hmm. You know, this species below the Earth's crust comes out of hibernation, wants to reclaim a planet they believe to be theirs. Mm-hmm. Not all of them are necessarily militant or violent, but it's a matter of who speaks loudest, you know, and the doctor trying to give everyone an opportunity to say their piece and deal with it diplomatically, but neither side has any patience for diplomacy, and it all goes to hell in a handbasket. Were there particular moments in this where you actually got surprised by some of the turns within the story? I mean, this is Malcolm Hulk here, I mean, using his particular flavor of science fiction along with interpersonal drama. How did it work for you?
Yeah. I probably would have been surprised by the Briggs decision to seal off the Silurian complex if I didn't know that there were, you know, another 30 years of Doctor Who coming where we don't share the Earth with the Silurians.
Okay. Yeah, that's one of the, I would say that particular characterization is one of those things where a lot of times when even some of the crew within the Doctor Who had described the Brig character sometimes as being a sort of a humorous offset. Ha ha ha. He's just there to sort of ground everything and be sort of the straight man to the Doctor's lunacy every once in a while. He's the Abbott to your Costello or what have you. But then you get moments like this where at the end of the day, he's still a company man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you need that kind of a reminder every once in a while. And I think that definitely hit home. So that, in fact, I remember as we were sitting watching this one, and we're going through the final story, and I'm surprised, you know, that my wife was kind of sticking with me on this one. She's getting through it. She's like, well, by about the beginning of episode six, she says, how many more does this have? I said, no, it's seven episodes. All right. She's like, well, there's points where they could have ended this like three times. I'm like, yeah, I okay. All right. That's all right. And then we get down to the final minutes of episode seven and that final decision where he, you know, blatantly, you know, just disregards what he had just said to the doctor. And she turns to me and goes, huh, I never knew the Brig had that kind of side to him. I'm like, okay, then this story has served its purpose as far as my estimation, you know, in giving some dimension or at least some complexity to recurring characters like the Brig and so forth. So, I'm glad that stuff's in there.
That's a long road to travel for one character moment, though.
It is true. Yeah. Haley's dead on. I mean, I could see easily, I think a four-story or a four-episode condensation of this, I can almost pinpoint scenes that can get trimmed down or out entirely.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, that's my only complaint about this was that, I mean, like I said, once you know the plot, there's a lot of dead weight and stuff that really doesn't need to be in there in the first place. It's just there to draw out the suspense.
Mm. And how many times do they have to get thrown into the little prison cells?
Oh, geez.
How many times do we have to listen to the Silurians fighting over who is going to be the great leader? How long does it take to put them in or out of the boxes? Huh. Just exactly wiggle your head. Long? Just keep it going. We need to kill 20 seconds. Just keep wiggling your head while I play the kazoo.
We got seven episodes to fill, guys. Keep wiggling.
Well, but I will say, I mean, when we put this out there and asked for some listener feedback, Sean Hutchins got back to us on Facebook and said, you know, it has been a few years since he's personally seen the story, but he does look upon it fondly, and he actually will defend the strange music. He actually enjoyed it. Fine, you're on your own on that one, Sean. But he did actually bring up a kind of an interesting point. He said the whole 1970 season had a very unique feel to it. And I think that's because, as we've discussed many times, this was a transition point for the program in general, as far as not only what they were trying to provide for the audience, but where they were trying to fit in within the BBC drama spectrum as a whole and make sure that they still accounted for some action slot within there. They needed to make sure that they were topically relevant, so they had to stay within, you know, all of the... you're dealing with the aftermath of, or at least the continuation of the civil rights movement. So there's certain degrees where those sort of topics come into the fore within the script material from moment to moment. And he also brought up that we get introduced to a couple of phenomenal actors, one of which comes around in Who numerous times. And then we've got Fulton McKay, who was just a hell of a lot of fun as the director. And then we go in and we see him in a lot of other work outside of Doctor Who to continue. And Jeffrey Palmer. Jeffrey Palmer, one of the few actors who has been able to come back around from classic into New Who. If you remember Voyage of the Damned, he was the captain of the ship there, Hardiker.
Yes. Okay. I thought he was, like, there was something about him that was familiar. I could not place it, though, for the life of me, and I refused to use IMDb before we actually record the episode.
Yeah. Face, kind of, you know, time sort of pulled down a little bit on the jowls there. But, yeah, Palmer is just he was a great asset to us. I think, in general, it is a solid story. I am really glad that we had this introduction to the Silurians because they obviously established themselves well. I mean, we get to see them two more times in Classic and then again in New Who, and to this day, obviously, with the Welsh contingency that looks considerably different among the race. Oh, look, 5 digits on each hand.
And no weird third eye that has mystical, magical, sonic screwdrivery properties.
Yeah. I do love the fact that the Doctor's continually saying, I can't find my sonic screwdriver. This entire thing. I just... And every time he mentions it, the scientists are... You think you're going to... This is a nuclear reactor. You're going to fix it with a screwdriver. Well, it's a sonic screwdriver, technically.
I was very pleased with the correct way that they pronounced nuclear throughout the entire series of episodes.
Well, they're Brits. They're going to get it right. It's nuclear.
I think N-U-K-U-L apostrophe R, right? Nuclear.
N-U-K-U-L-A-W-A-R. But yeah, I would say as far as recommendation level, because we tend to include that in our rewatches here about how likely you are to sit a fledgling Whovian down in front of it and say, yeah, this is one of the classics you should watch. 1 to 5 stars, where would you put this on that kind of a standing? And Haley, I'll ask you the first because you've just been exposed to this.
I think it's a good one to have in the mix because it is, I enjoy this, but definitely not like a first one because of the length. I don't think, you don't use this one to grab somebody, but if they're already kind of in, this is an okay one to show them.
Okay.
You know,
I've got something to add to that, but I want to get Jay's take on it.
I agree with Haley. This is not a top draft pick. It's, you know, if they're working their way through, yeah, definitely, you know, sit down and watch Silurians. I mean, you're learning who Pertwee's doctor is. You get the introduction of the Silurians. Like you said, you have that moment that kind of establishes who the Brig is and the duality of his character, or, you know, the different sides of him. And my favorite part of this, honestly, has to be Liz, because she really is standout. She really is like proving that she's not just the coffee fetcher. And I love that about her.
Very strong in this story, and gets to like flat out address a lot of the chauvinistic assumptions that are being thrown against her. And she puts it right back in the and the doctor's like, a lot of times, like almost physically holding her back. Whoa, 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 whoa. It's okay. Don't kill him. We still need him for a couple more minutes.
Yeah.
You know, but she's ready to tear right into somebody. So yeah, for the Liz factor alone, I absolutely agree with that. Haley, when you're talking about getting somebody who's starting to want to delve a little deeper, you know, maybe they want the Silurian origin story to a certain degree, even though you technically kind of get it three times from three different angles, depending on which story you want to jump into. But I wonder if this is somebody who is really starting to pick up on the Third Doctor, maybe they see Spearhead. You'll get to see a couple more stories as we go through this chronologically, where I would probably say in retrospect, I might jump around with Pertwee and say, no, watch this one. Wait until they really get hooked on his doctor's persona and then say, all right, now there's this one. Even though that you might be working backwards from a few you just watched. Oh, and by the way, skip these two episodes, and I'll just give you a two-sentence synopsis to be able to jump over and save yourself a little bit of time and make a four-episode story out of it.
Yeah. I think this is a good one to get, though, because of that moment with the Brig at the end. Because from Spearhead, and from what I saw of him, at least, with Troughton, we kind of just get him as, like, a yes-man military sidekick to the Doctor up to that point. And this, you see where, you know, he's got his own agenda. He's not here just to facilitate the Doctor doing his thing. He's got a mission to do for Earth that is not necessarily always going to line up with what the Doctor wants to do.
Right, yeah. And even though they're technically, they do make a point to try and differentiate UNIT from the actual, you know, this isn't the Queen's Army or anything of that sort, and they try to make that distinction, but he's answering to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody. So whoever that high command is, and I do like the fact that within the story you actually get both sides of it. You get the you get the Brig coming to the Doctor's defense to a number of people, you know, saying, you know, oh, he's absolutely allowed to be here. You know,
yeah, no, we don't have a name, but we'll let him into our top secret nuclear facility.
Right, his opinion trumps yours, Mr. Director of the entire nuclear facility, because he came with me. And you obviously haven't done your job because you've called us in. I brought him along. Therefore, he outranks you in the decision-making process right now. And then to have that, and to have, because you know, that's what we would expect from the Brig up to this point, and all of a sudden to have this moment where it's an outright defiance and a flat-out lie to dismiss him. And then, you know, the closing credits come right as the Doctor goes, huh, okay, so that's what you did. You know, their relationship is now changed.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to see how that's going to reflect in stories to come, which we will do. But overall, yeah, I would say this is, I'd agree with you both. I think this is one that some people may actively want to seek out. And you can preface it. You can say, all right, this is a long one. You can choose whether or not you want to delve into it. Here are the pros. Here are the cons. Make the decision for yourself. I encourage you to see it if you want to. But I understand if you want to tap out of it. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
I'm cool with that.
Again, it's more about knowing your audience than anything else.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. As is the case with 90% of Who and probably 100% of Torchwood.
This did bring up a question for me, though. The Silurians come back in later episodes of Classic Who. Mm-hmm. Does the Doctor ever meet them like at the height of their own empire?
No.
Mm-mm. Nope.
In all instances, is them kind of emerging to the surface trying to reclaim. I think it'd be kind of cool if they ever decided to step back and see the Silurians pre-hibernation.
Yeah.
Mm.
When it was their planet.
See, when the...
And that would be a great one of those, like, oh, the TARDIS did something wonky kind of things, where it's like, oh, no, we're still on Earth. And then you step outside, and it's lizard people.
And we actually see the humans as the apes that they keep on referring to them as, and yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I love the fact that when they're looking at the monitor... and they're looking at a chimp, and then it cuts to Baker in the jail cell, and you're like, yeah, it's pretty close. The same sort of blank expression, kind of sweaty, pasty. Yeah. But they, I'm wondering, I'd have to go and see whether there was any, I mean, obviously we know not within televised, but I'm trying to think within any of the extended materials, whether they've actually gone back and done that. I know they've done sort of alternate realities. But yeah, I don't think they've ever actually gone back that far. I'll research that one. If I come up with anything, I'll throw it in the comments on this. Okay. But yeah, so there you go. And we will be returning to our classic rewatch in a couple of weeks to go the next step into the Pertwee era with Ambassadors of Death, which is a wholly enjoyable story. Yes. So, but we'll get to that shortly. All right, so with just a couple, looking under the tree here, just a few more unwrapped presents that are still in our Eli Who gift assortment, we have decided this week to unwrap the interview that Haley and I were able to do with the dashing unit rifleman himself, Captain Yates, or as we know him today, the wonderful Richard Franklin. So some time spent talking about his past, his present, and all points in between. So we are absolutely honored this morning to be able to sit for just a few brief moments with none other than Richard Franklin. Thank you so much, Mr. Franklin, for joining us here in New York this weekend.
Oh, no, thank you very much indeed. It's been absolutely wonderful so far.
Prior to screen career, prior to your theatrical career, you actually had a military career as a rifleman, if I remember correctly, during your national service.
Yeah, absolutely. I was in a regiment called the Royal Green Jackets. In fact, I was at the, I think it was the last but 1 year of conscription in Britain. I didn't want to go into the army at all. And once I got there, I absolutely loved it. I don't like the idea of killing people. I never had to kill anybody. And if I were faced in that situation, God knows what I'd do, because I just do not approve of killing. I think it's much better to create a model society and make certain you can defend yourself if somebody wants to take your basic principles away from you. But interventionism, no.
Very much the doctor's approach, I would say.
I think so, yeah, absolutely.
Well, as this is Veterans Day here in the States, I know we have Remembrance Day as well overseas, so we do absolutely thank you for your service.
Thank you very much. We've just had a very nice veterans breakfast here.
Wonderful.
And it's one of the lovely things, I think, that Doctor Who does. It looks outwards into the real world. And in a very gentle way, it introduces some nice ideas on ecology and peace and so on.
Very much so. Now, do you feel that your service gave you a particular a comfort level or a deeper understanding of Yeats in portraying a soldier's role?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Okay. Definitely. The lovely thing about unit, which, of course, was the brigadier, the captain, the sergeant, and the doctor's assistant, with whom I was supposed to have love interest. Well, I certainly have love interest, but not on the show, because I think John Pertwee, who was a doctor at the time, felt that that would distract from the main focus, which I think he's probably right, actually.
There were some little hints, though, not for lack of trying
little hints,
on Yates'
yes.
part.
Yeah, little concern when she didn't turn up from after a dance or something, yeah.
Well, Yates became such a fast favorite among viewers in the 70s, but he still has an immediate appeal to newer fans who are seeing these stories for the first time today. What is it about his archetype that makes him so endearing? Or was it just you?
Well, of course, it's just me. No, not at all. I think that I also write plays, and I've written a Doctor Who play, which is called Recall Unit or The Great Teabag Mystery. And I found when I was writing it, it's extremely easy to write about Unit because it taps into, you talked about my character being an archetypal character. Mm. Absolutely correct. I mean, the Brigadier, we all like to think of Brigadiers and those in senior position as being a bit of buffoons. And he's a charming buffoon who often gets it right. Mm. Then you have, you know, the efficient love interest captain, and you have the strong physical sergeant.
The gruff strong arm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's a great trio, that. And, of course, in our case, we had the Daffy girl. Katie is completely mad. She knows I say this, and absolutely lovely. Mm-hmm. great fun, but she has a serious side as well. And I think that the Thinking Dust of Captain Mike Yates, which I played, it's very a very British character. Mm-hmm. And I'm a pretty traditional British person, which meant that when I wrote my book, Operation Hate, which is what happened to my character when he left the planet of the spiders and left UNIT, I found that Mike Yates and Richard Franklin are very close, and therefore I was able to include and either exaggerate or lie about my own autobiography in the book, which is purports to be Mike Yates's story.
Wheels within wheels.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm interested that you mentioned about the intent of bringing UNIT into the program. We had a chance to speak with Derek Sherwin last year at this event, and he was describing creating UNIT as being a military presence that was sort of a from the headlines significance for Britain and British viewers at the time. Do you feel that that same sort of relevance to what UNIT represented for, or maybe even continues to represent for viewers of the program in its modern inception, as far as having that military persona, but not necessarily governmentally affiliated?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that I think I mentioned a moment ago that I was in the Royal Green Jackets as a real soldier and actually as a real captain as well. And it was a very fortunate choice, because the Green Jackets are very much the sort of unit and sort of soldier and sort of, yes, non-governmental style of soldier that you were talking about. If it's necessary to not disobey the rules, but to use your intelligence to move quickly in another direction, that's what the Green Jackets do. And the discipline is certainly there, but it's a much more relaxed, I would say, a more intelligent sort of discipline than you get in some regiments where people shout at you and you march and all that sort of thing. You turn left and you turn right. In the Green Jackets, you're very much encouraged, right from a rifleman up to field marshal, you're encouraged to think for yourself and think for your colleagues as well.
Very much in the spirit of UNIT, then.
In the spirit of UNIT, yeah.
Wonderful. Well, Mr. Franklin, thank you so much for spending a couple of moments with us this morning. We definitely appreciate it. We hope you have a fantastic weekend with us here in New York.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's all over so quickly. actually, I've been in New York for all the shenanigans that's been going on this week, which is very interesting.
Interesting is a
very
safe word.
We won't go into it. I don't talk politics.
What's next, Jay?
Well, we've got some news.
News. Haley, do it.
News.
Do it.
All right, let's start with the good news.
Yeah.
So this is kind of fitting as we're in the Third Doctor era in our rewatch. Paul Cornell's Third Doctor series with Titan Comics is really, really fantastic stuff. I mean, this stuff is phenomenal. But number four is set to come out, I believe, this Wednesday, actually. So yep. By the time you listen to this, it's already out.
By the time you're reading this, you're probably reading this. So, yes, the Heralds of Destruction is dropping this week. Christopher Jones taking the artistry again, and I think as we've also experienced in previous titles, both with Mr. Cornell at the pen and otherwise, I think between the two of them, they are able to capture a lot of the spirit of these individuals, of the actors, of their relationships, particularly when you're dealing with the Doctor and Joe, and some of that great rapport.
Yeah.
So that's worth a pickup right there. This is also a heavily unit-oriented story, which is awesome. So I get more Brig, so yeah. I'm satisfied and looking forward to this one dropping. So I have to do a bit of a drive to get to my comic shop that actually does carry Titan titles, unless I order them in advance. I should probably do that, but I don't.
I know, it's such a hassle for me, too. I've got to walk like a whole block and a half. It's crazy. The things I do.
Yeah.
I swear. Mm-hmm.
I like living in the woods. We got bears.
Drop yeah. bears.
But also to put on there as far as the I would categorize this as the good news. This is just fun news. It's yeah. nice news. And it segues well about talking about my life here in the woods. I've got my TARDIS chicken coop in the backyard, and this guy one-upped me by a long shot.
This guy like seven-upped you.
Yeah, yeah. He just can you one to the no. One to the whatever the power doesn't even count. It's still one. Anyway.
Yeah.
So Paul Foden of, I don't know where this guy is out in the UK. I'm not exactly sure where he is. But he went from the idea of saying that, you know, I should stick a TARDIS alongside my garden shed because it'd be really funny to kind of replace the door into my shed with a TARDIS. And then he decided to say, well, I'll just turn the entire interior of my garden shed into a full TARDIS interior, so you can actually walk into the thing.
I like to think he's got a pile of garden tools behind it.
Yeah, behind I don't have any room now. For the actual tools.
No, they're all under a tarp behind the thing, yeah.
Yeah.
He's just got the wheelbarrow upside down over him.
It's just insane. So, yeah, the photos will do justice, will do some justice to it, but it is a very, very impressive arrangement in there, from the console to his interior displays to the round things, and the sheer amount of money that he has spent over the course of the past year and a half or so putting this thing together. He had already started. He was already a kind of a prop replicator for fun. He had done a kind of a Cyberman and a Dalek, and then he said, "Well, you know, if I'm going to go from there, you know, it's only natural I go big." Definitely look it over. It's been getting a lot of attention over the last couple of days, and it's worth it because it's just a lot of fun. It's a labor of love, and it definitely pays off. He's become a little tourist attraction in this neighborhood.
Well, you know, Kier, what you could do is you could make your own garden shed that looks like a TARDIS, but use a different Doctor's TARDIS, and then you've got your own little Two Doctors TARDIS, Two Doctor special happening in your backyard.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I totally want my Baker TARDIS then. I want a little shorter, squatter, dark blue. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. With all the free time you've got coming up, you should do that.
Yeah. Exactly. This is going to work out well.
Sure.
Yep.
I could. I have a lot of cosplay to work on too. little tiny cosplay. So.
All right. So the last article that we've got here is, I wouldn't necessarily classify this as bad news, but it's definitely not of the exciting variety. So, Class has made its premiere on BBC One, which they put into a very late time slot, 10:45 p.m. This has not translated well in ratings.
Well, I don't have a lot of perspective for what is good for British television ratings. But it does say that episode 2, even though the ratings weren't as good as the first episode, it still won the time slot.
I don't know. They say, but in both cases, because they did as we did, you know, as we got on when it broadcasts like in space or any of the other, well, at least here in North America, sorry, America, but at least the Canadian distributions where they did it, you got the first two episodes, bang on first time, because they wanted you to be able to get through not only the Capaldi handoff, but they wanted you to see where the crew's going to go within their first story on their own. So, but the, they note in both of these instances that for the time slot, that it was lower than the average for BBC One for the 10:45 p.m. and then the following 11:40 p.m. where they put the Coach with the Dragon Tattoo. So yeah. It doesn't bode well. But I personally don't think that that time slot was ideal for this program.
Yeah.
It's yet another weird decision about how they're treating this show on a global level.
Yeah,
in both it's getting released and when it's getting released.
I, as much as this might sound like a blow, I'm not too worried about it because, one, it's, I mean, yes, you're putting it on an incredibly late time, so people aren't typically going to stay up until, you know, 11:30 at night just to catch an episode of a show that, let's face it, they've probably already seen, because fans of Doctor Who, if they're going to want to watch a spinoff, they're already going to have seen it. But, you know, they're not going to sit around and wait for it to come on BBC One. So they've already seen it. You know, it's, I don't know. I think that
But isn't the hope with this to try and scoop in viewers that aren't part of the Whovian spectrum to begin with?
And that might be the case. And at that point...
But again, if you're trying to get people that aren't already fans, I don't think a late night time slot is the way to do that.
That's the other thing. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you might catch, you know, some of the, I mean, let's face it, the demographic for this is going to be the, you know, the teenagers. That's really what they're aiming for. So yeah, that kind of makes sense that you'd put it on late night. You're coming home from a friend's house, whatever. It's maybe you try and catch them, but I really think, I honestly think that this was more a bid to, hey, we need something to fill this time slot. Why don't we bring class on, put it on here and see what, you know, just see what happens. Maybe we'll get a couple extra people. I don't think it was necessarily geared that way. It was just a fringe benefit if it happened.
Yeah. There's also something that has to be considered really when you're looking at the, at that, if that's a, one of your target demographics at this stage in the way broadcast television works, no one, you know, how many teens, whether they be, you know, your early teens or in this case where they're sort of targeting, you know, 16 to 19 or so, or maybe even a little skewing a little bit older, actually watch television live time.
Yeah.
Really. I don't.
Yeah. So, I mean, at this point, the dailies, the overnights, the plus twos or however you want to rate them. I don't really know how that qualifies. I understand at the end of the day, they still have programming directors who need to say, well, something needs to go on the air at this point, and they need to do their best job with that. But as far as the viability of a program, especially when you're going towards that bracket, that has to be an extremely difficult thing to say, you know, what can you possibly put on the air that isn't live that's going to get people to watch at the exact moment that you broadcast it? I think live events are probably one of the only things I know that have that degree of urgency or immediacy to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only live things I can think of that I've watched in the last year were like the debates and then election coverage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or you get into something where, you know, maybe awards. We just had the Golden Globes in the States, you know, and you get people that, you know, they want to watch those things because you don't want to find out later or what have you.
Well, but for that, I don't really care about that. Like, what I care about is the moments that people are going to put up on YouTube the next day. And I'm fine watching that when it shows up on YouTube.
The moments like Ryan Reynolds and Andrew Garfield sharing a kiss.
That was magical.
I'm not arguing that.
Wow. So, but in keeping with that topic of class, that's what we will actually be returning to next week. We get back into, we've got two episodes to go. We want the other half of what was happening while the kids were in detention. So we get episode 7, The Metaphysical Engine, or as we much more really want to refer to it, the second half of the title, What Quill Did. That's all I want to know. What happened to your eye?
I'm excited.
Why your
about
hair so long?
This one looks it's going to be fun.
Did you get extensions?
Oh, man. Yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun. And then we only have one more episode after that. That's like, this went by way too quick and way That's too true. Long. Like, it's dragging very, on very so long, but...
But it is going to give us the opportunity to start playing around with some fun stuff in between our classic rewatches, too. We're going to get back into some of our games. We've got a couple of topics that have been suggested to us from listeners. There have been a couple of things that have emerged from some of our con panels that we think might make some interesting cast discussions. And we're actually going to be turning the microphone back to some of you kids a little bit in the weeks and months to come, too. Mm-hmm. Because it may be January, but by April...
We're going to have stuff to talk about.
Just around the corner.
All things being relative, yes. In the history of human existence, this is like a blip on the scope.
All right. Well, this has been episode 216 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, there are times, Doctor, when you sorely try my patience.
This is Kier saying, stupid bumbling idiots, the pair of them.
And this is Haley saying, I need dragons for power!
Oh, God.
It's all I can think about the whole episode.
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
I don't see.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Sinking in 1, 2, 3.
I heard that and then saw it.
In my world, sound travels faster than light. Thank you, Google Hangouts, for inverting physics.
This is the Googleverse. Your laws have no power here.
Oh, God, no. I'm in the Googleverse. We're all doomed.
Oh. Have fun cleaning that one up, Kier.
Nope, gonna leave it like it was. All our listeners heard was power. God. So last night, Julie falls asleep early, and I'm playing around with the infrared camera. So I'm laying there in bed, and I got the thing pointed, and I'm like, I wonder what's going on in the kitchen. So I'm like scanning all over the place. Nothing going on over here. Okay, cat dish. Nobody's over there. And I scroll over towards this random spot on the floor. And there's Gaius. And he's just sitting there. Just whatever. Not doing anything. He's sitting staring into space. And I watch him for about a full minute. I'm like, all right. I don't know what the cat's doing. But I'm going to read my book. I'm not going to pay any attention. So I leave the screen on. And I set the thing over on my nightstand. And it's 10 o'clock on the button. I knew for a fact. So I start reading my book. 15 minutes goes by, and I look over at the thing. The cat is still in the same spot. In the middle of nowhere on the kitchen floor, staring at the middle distance, doing nothing. So I take a screen capture of it, because it has the time code up in the top. Another 15 minutes goes by. The cat is still there, doing nothing. Take another screenshot. 10 minutes more. Nothing. Like, to the point where now I gotta know what the hell's he I can't sleep because I gotta know what the hell the cat's doing. So I walk out there, nothing. There's nothing there. I thought maybe he was watching a mouse or something. Nothing. He just stopped thinking when the lights turned off.